Welcome to the video podcast, Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed, where truth and unity matter. Take the deep dive with highly influential voices in and around the 9/11 truth movement.
Yes, and welcome everybody. It is really good to have you back again. And where am I? I'm over here. Hi, everybody. It's Richard Gage, 9/11 Unleashed, and we are back with an exciting guest today. Well, we can decide how exciting it is, but informative and revolutionary in terms of addressing what we've been told about 9/11 and what really happened. We're looking at the chemistry of 9/11 today, the chemistry of the World Trade Center. And that's exciting to me because for 15 years, I've been doing nothing but trying to get the word out to those who don't know yet about what really happened at the World Trade Center, because it changed our world fundamentally. The Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012 stripped us of liberties, started a $6.5 trillion global war on terror, and it's still going on in many different forms. So let me tell you about my guest today. And let's move him up here. Yep. Niels Harrit, PhD, the lead author of the groundbreaking 2009 peer-reviewed paper, Active Thermitic Materials in the World Trade Center Dust. Published in the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal in 2009, documenting the discovery of energetic materials. He's lectured extensively all over the world on the World Trade Center evidence, as documented in the scientific paper. And here he dives deeper into the chemistry revealed in the World Trade Center dust, as well as the carbon nanotubes in the lungs of the 9/11 first responders that were found and that puzzled doctors immensely. What else was found? Incendiaries optimized for enormous heat, which is very slow. Is that what was found? Or was it explosives optimized for the most rapid gas expansion to knock things over? Or propellants optimized for propulsion at moderate speeds? Yeah, you're going to hear about this today. We're going deeper than you've gone before. So whatever you thought you knew about nanothermite, stand ready to have your eyes opened. More importantly, even, what are the implications of these findings? You see, I'm unleashed now. And my guest has been unleashed for quite some time. So we're going to have a good time. Why are these red-gray chips that are so talked about found throughout the World Trade Center dust? Who could be responsible for their placement? Yeah, we're going to get into it. Niels is the author of more than 60 published peer-reviewed papers on chemistry and was co-founder of the Nanoscience Center at the University of Copenhagen. He served as associate professor of chemistry at the University of Copenhagen from 1971 until his retirement in 2009. We'll ask Niels if that was coincident with the publication of his paper in the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal in 2009. Ladies and gentlemen, give a warm welcome, a warm unleashed welcome to Professor Niels Harrit. Hi, Niels.
Hi, Richard. And thank you for having the honor to be with you on your new Unleashed show. Great honor.
Thank you. It's just awesome to have you here back again. I mean, I see you when I have the rare occasion to come and visit in Denmark and speak. And we speak together on platforms and several locations now. And it's just always been an incredible pleasure to work side by side with you ever since I got to know you before 2009, even. And we've just been putting it out there, haven't we?
That was in seven, wasn't it? That was the three blue beams in New York, which Barbara put up. I think that was the first time we met, wasn't it? Could be, yeah.
Yes, yes. Barbara Honegger has incredible
quite an experience. Yes,
that was one of them.
Yeah.
The third beam, of course, represented World Trade Center 7. The two beams were already there, put up by officials. And what we did is strategically place a third beam composed of four searchlights mounted on a pickup truck. And then we've got the right angle and got the photo. And we wanted to bring attention to Building 7, didn't we, Niels?
That was really a feat, really.
Yeah.
And I understand that Barbara was the initiative, took the initiative for doing that. That was great. I mean, I remember the moment we were standing. I was at West Broadway Street or was it Church Street? And looking down when the third beam came up. Wow. Yeah. Fantastic.
It was too cool. Very too cool. Well, let me introduce you to my wonderful wife and assistant, Gail Gage. Hello, Gail.
Hello, Richard. And hello, Niels. What an honor to meet you and listen. And also welcome to all of, thank you. Welcome to all of our wonderful listeners right now, present and future.
Yes, absolutely. And why are you here, Gail? Tell people why you're here.
Well, many reasons, but right now at the very moment, I'm here to assist all of our wonderful viewers that are watching this live stream in real time with all their wonderful questions. So at the end of the podcast, I'll gather up all those questions that I can find and we'll be able to ask Niels.
Yes, and they can leave questions during the live stream on Facebook and where else?
All of the social media. We're on Twitter, LinkedIn, two Facebook accounts, and YouTube.
Wow.
And we are adding more platforms to our list. So pretty soon you'll be able to find the podcast on other places.
All right. Well, it's good to have you here. And let us know if we have any difficulties, technical issues. You can interrupt us if you can't hear, for instance. That means no one else can hear. So we'll just put you aside for now, but we'll keep you in our hearts. How's that?
Sounds wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's get back to Niels. Now, Niels, how did you first become aware that 9/11 was something different than you thought?
Well, that was in 2006, and it's a very common story. When you ask this question to all the old veterans of the truth movement, because everything happened around 2005, 2006. And I believe that that was coupled to the advent of YouTube. Actually, we could suddenly see videos. But what happened to me was that my now wife, Pernille, who you have met, she had sent to her a couple of DVDs anonymously because she has been involved in the peace movement for 40 years at that time. Mm. We believe that was the reason why. And when I slid one of these DVDs into the DVD viewer, I saw a presentation by an American professor called Stephen Earl Jones from the Brigham Young University. He gave one of his very first presentations, which was recorded. And at that moment, I remember it vividly when I saw Building 7 the first time. What? A third skyscraper? I've never heard about that before. So I was very upset for two reasons. One was that I haven't seen it before, which meant that the Danish mainstream media had decided that I was not supposed to have seen this before. And the other thing is that I just couldn't gather while this building was collapsing. This is a bend of my nature. I'm a natural scientist. All of my life, I've been trying to figure out what is going on around me in the physical world. And as I grew older, I think I'm pretty good at it and understand much of what is happening when what I see. But this, I just couldn't. What? And I pushed the button 10 times and my jaw dropped further and further down. And then I tried to put it aside, as most people do. And maybe, no, I know you didn't do that. But most people get a feeling, here is something I don't, it's painful. I mean, to going down this path will mean a lot of hassle and a lot of pain. So I try to put it aside. And in a couple of weeks, and this is my experience, it takes 4 to 6 weeks to actually digest that very first impression until you have to go back. So I lifted just a corner of the carpet, you know, and it didn't look too good. And then you look further and it got worse and worse. At that time in my life, I have never submitted anything for a newspaper. But in the spring of 2007, I got around to doing that. And by accident, and this is what has happened to me, whenever I had anything in the mainstream newspaper, it has always been a misstep by some journalist. But I actually, after some hassle with one paper and another one, I actually had what you would call an essay in a Danish newspaper called, and that was called The Seventh Tower. Not by me, but by the journalist who we knew, he put that title on, and I kind of liked that. It has a Tolkien kind of ring to it, The Seventh Tower. So I've used that ever since as a headline for my presentations. And that was very neutral. I was just saying, hey, look, there were two airlines and three skyscrapers, and it's coming down in free fall acceleration. I mean, that was all there was in. And so I thought, I was very naive at the time, and I thought, if you just step onto a soapbox in the corner of Regent's Park, you know, Speaker's Corner, and you yell the truth out in the universe, it would take a life on its own. But absolutely zero happened afterwards. Dead silence. Okay. And then I thought, then I have to put a presentation together, which I know I can, which I've been done for 40 years. And so I started doing presentations in August of 2007, which actually over the years has evolved into 400 presentations. I know you beat me on that, but I'm a proud number two, I believe, on a global scale in the number of 9/11 presentations. Yes.
An incredible history.
And then it happened, and there was a good, actually Australian living in Denmark called Gavin Wheatley, who called me and asked, do you mind if I translate your essay into English and put it on my website? And I said, okay, fine. So he did that. And that eventually, there's another coincidence, and that was that I was referee on a paper which Kevin Ryan and Stephen Jones submitted for the Environmentalist about the emissions out of Ground Zero. And, you know, I was a referee on the paper. The journal asked me to review their paper. And that's how I got involved with Kevin, because what happened is that when a scientist submit a paper, an article for a journal, the authors do not know the referees. They're anonymous. But of course, the referees do know the authors. And they have the freedom, actually, to contact the authors. And it happens quite frequently that the referee decides that it would make things much easier if I contact the authors directly and we clarify whatever there is to clarify within us, so we bypass the journal. Much better article out of it. And the same thing happened actually with the nanothermite paper. That's another thing. Oh. But in this case, I got into discussing the data they were presenting in the Environmentalist about the emissions coming out of the ground. You may know this paper in the Environmentalist. It's about the emissions coming out of Ground Zero in the days after 9/11.
which and tell is us a little bit more
outrageous. About, pardon?
Tell us a little bit more about the abstract, if you will, of that first paper you guys worked on together and the findings.
No, we didn't work on together. I was a referee.
Oh, you were the referee.
And I remained a referee, but it makes things much easier. I mean, if you clarify any discrepancies before you resubmit the paper, it goes straight through. So I don't have to write to the journal and say, I have this and this criticism.
Right.
And then it goes back and forth. You shortcut the process, which is absolutely, I'm in favor of it if when necessary. Okay. Well, because it makes it you get a paper. Pardon? Okay.
What did they find?
This is all official data, actually, from what you call Environmental Protection Agency of the emissions coming out of Ground Zero. And you should ask Kevin about it because this has been many years since I read this. But yeah. There was eruptions of gases coming out of the ground in like volcanoes eruptions on specific days, completely blowing all limits of what there should be. I could drop names, styrene, benzene, propylene, and all kind of gases coming out. And among them, one very special, which is called 1,3-diphenylpropane, which is, so far, we haven't had a good explanation for that specific chemical. And this is all official data. But they're completely, you cannot explain them by any conventional fire or collapse or anything.
Or plastics in the aftermath, burning?
Yeah, that was one of the things I did as a referee, actually going through all the possible sources from these gases. And we didn't get to the bottom of it. So it was published with this, basically this question still being left open. But many of the gases you can explain by polystyrene and polyvinyl chloride and ordinary plastics being burned. But one obvious thing is that it was a gigantic bitch's brew, which not even kept burning but kept reacting. I mean, the Ground Zero was reacting. Like a gigantic, I don't know what to compare it with. And you know, as I know, that officially the fires was not extinguished officially until December the 20th, right? But there were eruptions of strange chemicals far into February. So this alone should characterize Ground Zero as a bitch's brew of chemistry and very serious chemistry. And this was what they published in The Environmentalist. And following that exchange, they asked me to join what's the work which Stephen actually had initiated at that point. We are in late 2007. And I think Professor Jones came out with the first nanochip he presented in Boston in December the 12th, right? And I joined the team right afterwards, and we kind of split it between the University of Copenhagen and in Utah, where Jeffrey Farah is a very important person, and he usually do not get the credit he deserves because he was the master of the key instrument used for these investigations. So that is the story of that. Yes. Your voice is off. I don't hear you. Do you hear me?
Sorry. Please do develop this story of how this work began to be. So Stephen Jones first had found red gray chips, which puzzled him. He presented that in Boston. I was there. It was one of the most exciting moments ever.
Yeah.
And the 9/11 truth movement for all of us.
Yeah.
Finally got some evidence and some traction here. but it hadn't been peer reviewed. So what was the process of you guys coming together, as you've started to share with us already, and how did that develop?
Well, it's nothing out of the ordinary. I mean, this is academic how you work together. But it took 18 months before it came out eventually. And it was submitted the first time very early. And then the thing actually happened. There's been so much fuss about this peer review process, and people are putting more into it that it actually people think that if a paper is peer reviewed, it must be the absolute truth, which is not correct. The peer review method or methodology is not what you say faultless, but it's the best thing we have. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have some of your peers reading through it, and that time actually it happened to one of the referees. It was completely according what there was nothing unusual in the whole process. One of the referees actually came back and say, I want you to do these and these control experiments. He delayed the whole process by 3 months.
Oh.
So it was submitted twice, actually. Oh. It turned out, God bless him, because we came out with a better paper in the end. The control experiment did not reveal anything new, but the extra 3 months we got for putting the things together definitely make it, it was a better paper which came out of it. But at the time, I was quite annoyed that he delayed the process. Looking back, we should be grateful because we had more time to put it together. It was a better paper, but Stephen should have all the credits for getting the idea, starting the work, and Jeffrey Farrar should have his share of the credits for being a very key person at this electron microscope, which at that time at Brigham Young University was a far better instrument than we had in Copenhagen at that time. Gotcha. He's a master. And it's very important that you have a person on an instrument of this complexity who can really do the experiments.
Mm. So. Well, let's tell people what we're talking about. We kind of ran right over that. Something was found in the dust, and I understand 7 independently collected samples were sent to your group. And what was the process you used, and what did you find in the dust that caused so much fuss?
Well, what you do is you have, I have some dust over here. You want me to go and get it?
Yeah.
I can show you exactly how you do it.
Okay. Let's see the actual dust. Put on
30 seconds. Yeah. 30 seconds, if I can find it.
Oh, gosh. So I have some dust here, too, at my house. And I have pieces of World Trade Center 7 that are broken up, the granite panel. And provided to me by a special customs agent who was working on the site. I don't think I'm supposed to tell anybody that I have it, so I won't tell you his name, but thank you very much for providing these samples to me. It's an honor to have pieces of World Trade Center 7 here. And, I will show them to you later, as a matter of fact, after Niels comes back. And there's Neil.
Yes, there's something here. And then I have actually I have 2 super magnets, which you should not, which is kind of a serious thing. And I should take my watch off. Yeah, and I don't use a pacemaker because this is 2 magnets.
Okay,
and you really need to use to get them apart.
So one of the reasons
I haven't done this for a time. Here you go.
Attracted Stephen's attention is because these chips are attracted to a magnet. What's the relevance of that? Well, we'll watch first. Go ahead.
I'm not sure you can see it because it's so small, but this is a super magnet, neodymium cobalt magnet, I can see something sticking, the field, not really the field, but the gradient, it's strongest at the edges. At the edges of this is a silinear. You can see the silinear here. So the edges are where the attraction is the greatest. So you pull it very carefully around. And we will never use a batch like this for this when we did in real time. But while you do it, you pull it very slowly along the plastic bag, and you cannot see it, but I can see that something is coming along at the edge of the magnet, and much of it actually is the ion spheres, because they are ferromagnetic. But the red gray chips is what you called. We don't need this anymore. Now you got the point, okay? You got it. Okay. That's how you do, by doing that you can collect whatever is attracted by the magnet in the dust, and some of it is the ion spheres.
Well, talk about these iron spheres and how that relates to what we're talking about.
Well, maybe we should wait. Let's wait a little bit about it. With this, because okay. The red gray chips comes along because they contain some iron oxide, and which is super paramagnetic in this case. That means it's still, and super paramagnetism means that it's being attracted to the magnet. Okay. So this is how you kind of get rid of all the pulverized concrete.
So are paint chips attracted to a magnet?
Nope.
Because they don't have a high enough iron content?
Right.
Oh
well, I haven't checked all the paintings in the world. Could be
typical primer.
Could be
these chips look like.
There are thousands kinds of primer paint, but it's irrelevant. I mean, it's not a criterion for whether this is the real stuff or not. We'll get to that later. It's just how you get rid of all the pulverized concrete. You saw the sample was gray. Much of it is just pulverized, whatever.
Yeah.
But and so you have to, what you get there is a minor fraction there's also small iron chips, which is relevant in this connection. Whatever is being attracted to the magnet comes along, and that incorporates the ion spheres and the red gray chips.
Okay.
And some of them are not reactive, but it's the reactive stuff which is interesting in this connection.
Yeah.
And it takes a bit of experience when you get them under the microscope. So whatever you get from the magnet, you put under the microscope and make a selection. I had to when I started out doing this to train to spot the chips. But of course, Stephen was a master of that because he had practiced more. The chips then is put into into the electron microscope, and that is where Jeffrey Farrow comes into the picture. And this is one of the what you're showing here, the bilayered. The previous picture is better because it's a red side of it, which is interesting. And you may recognize that rust is red, and this is because there are iron compounds, iron oxides in it. It's not rust per se, but it is. There are many kind of iron oxides, and rust is one of them. So if you call it rust, you may call it rust. It doesn't matter. The point here is that when you heat these chips, they react. And that is the key observation, really. You may say the characterization of the material is important, of course. But the key observation which distinguishes these chips from, what say, any primer paint or whatever, is the reactivity.
Uh-huh.
Because ordinary paint does not react. Shouldn't.
When you say react, you're talking about an exothermic reaction. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, and development of gas. Eventually, we'll reach that point later on. Yeah, but this is what you see here. And this is the heat being involved. And this is actually in the differential scaling calorimeter, which is a big instrument. The smaller the sample, the bigger the instrument, where you measure evolution of heat when during a chemical process. So what you do here is that you put your chip into the calorimeter and you heat it up, and then you see around some of these are different samples here. But I would say the best one, it ignites at 430. I would say the red one is the prettiest one of these four. But these are the four different samples, which means that it's the same stuff we're picking out from the four samples which actually ended up in the publication. You were talking about how we got the samples. And when we started writing it up, Stephen insisted that we should have a big session of the chain of custody. And I thought, I was young and very, no, I was not young, but I was very naive at that time. And I thought, why should we spend three pages on chain of custody or four pages? Who would ever accuse of falsifying or tangling with the chips? I mean, who would ever do that? I was very naive, but Stephen insisted, and okay. So there are chain of custodies and what do you call affidavits and from we had at that time we had five good samples, but only four of the original contributors was ready to put forward with video testimonies and what you call all these forms they're filling out for chain of custody. The fifth person said, "No, I want to stay out of this." So we took all the data from the fifth sample out of it, actually.
Oh,
so and I'm glad we did that.
Well, what is an exothermic reaction?
It's a reaction which develops heat. An endothermic reaction, you're using heat. It's quite rare, actually, because usually chemical reactions are exothermic. I mean, heat are being developed because nature runs downhill. So there's always heat in excess.
So paint doesn't do this?
No, not on its own. I mean, this is the primer paint has to be certified for fireproofing. There's a procedure for that. Of course, you don't use primer paint in the world for steel on a steel beam if it reacts when you heat it up. At the contrary, it's being tested again and again according to, I don't remember the name of this procedure, but there's a specific protocol for testing primer paint for heat stability, of course. this is so obvious.
Well, it's not obvious to the rest of us, so I'm grateful to have you explain it.
Well, I know you have been into steel frame building construction, and you would not put up a steel beam with primer paint on, which eventually react and explode if the building catches fire, will you? So it has been tested. Of course, all the paint has been tested.
Yeah. Gotcha. All right. Well, that's really important. So what happens then? You see this stuff producing all this energy and gas in the DSC, differential scaling calorimeter, what happens next?
Nothing.
In your process. What do you do with the results? So what's your next step?
In this case, I mean, from the you take out the chip after you've done this from the calorimeter and put it in the optical microscope. And take a look at it. And there are pictures in the paper of these samples. And there you can see all the ion spheres.
Okay.
And that's actually a very important piece of evidence. These are from the dust samples. This is from the World Trade Center dust. Which means that the evolution of heat is connected to the formation of iron spheres. And that is the reactivity, which is the key observation. I mean, this paper is very long. And if you don't care about long, boring scientific papers, the only qualitative evidence you should take out from the paper is the reactivity. And, right, yeah, that is another beautiful picture. Actually, the upper one to the left is not from the calorimeter. It has been burned on the bench, so to say. But yes, it is. And you can see the irons, it is not exactly a sphere, and that is because it solidifies so fast, it cools so fast, so it simply doesn't have time to get the spherical shape. But the spherical shape underneath is very important, because this is from the dust, where on this time scale where this is happening, it's slow. And I would get it's milliseconds, probably. It's still very fast, but it's slow enough for the sphere or for this liquid to form a sphere, because that is characteristic for droplets. I mean, if you have a liquid as a droplet, due to something called surface tension, it automatically creates a sphere. So the spherical shape proves that this material has been a liquid. And this is liquid iron, okay? And that is why the only explanation for that is that it comes out of the thermite reaction. And now we're just using the word thermite, you know, as a good old thermite, which goes back to the 1893 paper of a German chemist called Hans Goldschmidt, who made the original discovery of the thermite reaction. And that is the stuff. I know you have another picture from Stephen Jones's lab where you can buy the thermite mixture on eBay. And it contains a little more than iron oxide, and there's some additives in.
In fact, here's a controlled experiment, Niels, that Stephen Jones did. We can actually watch thermite igniting, right? What's going on here?
He's using a torch to start it off, because it's not so easy to get it going. You really need high temperature. Usually, sometimes you use magnesium, but it's quite really something is happening.
Well, what's that stuff down at the bottom then?
It's elemental iron, because you saw the aluminum oxide. Let me see again. You can't really see it, but there's a white cloud. There's a white cloud over the reaction, and that is aluminum oxide. This is the other product from the thermite reaction. Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's a huge white cloud that comes up really fast off of it. Some of these must be spheres, the iron spheres, right?
Yeah, probably. If you put it on the microscope, you cannot see it with a naked eye. We're talking about microns, thousands of millimeters, yeah.
And yet, I mean, what else could explain other than liquid falling molten iron droplets the toasting of the tops of these cars in and around the
filtration? No. This is reacting nanothermite, what is happening there.
Explain.
Because, maybe we are. This is the Twin Towers. And what you saw there is a canopy of debris and what is reacting material coming out like a mushroom cloud. If you have a picture of the destruction of the Twin Towers, you can see how everything is being thrown up and out And David Chandler has done a brilliant work on the videos, showing that you can see the explosions going on in the air when these things are flying out. And this is not small thing. Yeah, let's stay here. Because what you can see here, that every fragment is, which is being ejected from the Twin Towers, draws after them. It's not so clear. But you, if you have it, yeah, maybe to the left, you can see that every object here is drawing after a completely homogeneous white smoke trail, which nobody thought about until, say, 2010. I mean, well, I did, but I didn't understand it until 2010. Uh-huh. Because why should all the items being thrown out of the Twin Towers draw a white smoke trail after them? This is not concrete. I mean, if you throw a piece of concrete out of the window, it will not draw a white smoke trail. Or it's not what you call gypsum. Wallboard.
Yeah.
It's not wallboard either. I mean, if there was plenty of wallboard. That's another thing within the World Trade Center. But it will never draw a complete homogeneous smoke trail after them. Something is going on. There's a chemical reaction going on from each of these fragments.
Well, does this give us a clue? John Gross from the NIST project.
Not necessarily, because this is thermate. This is another thing. We may return to this later. This is not the nanothermite.
Okay.
But the nanothermite in my picture is serving as propellant, not as an explosive, not as an incendiary. The nanothermite did not cut the steel beams.
Uh-huh.
But it moved the outer panels out and away from the Twin Towers. And how can take 10 seconds? It took 10 seconds for the Twin Towers to collapse. It doesn't take 10 seconds to see what's going on here. this is not because, according to the official story, the only force acting on the towers at this moment is gravity.
Yeah.
And gravity can never do this. I mean, gravity is vertical. I mean, what can I do here? My watch here. Hey, you know, gravity goes like that. Game over. And everybody has been seeing it. But as we were watching in real time, and we all remember where we were when JF Kennedy was shot. And we all remember where we were when we saw this the first time. But we were in shock. We couldn't see what we saw.
Yeah.
But that is all it takes. And for many people, me incorporated, it took 5 years, at least 8 years, to see what we are seeing here. That's as simple as it is. I mean, shock and awe, it works so efficiently, right? We cannot see what we see. Yeah, they're very good at it. Well, so let's roll back, because what you're seeing here, all the smoke trails here, is the second product of the thermite reaction. This is aluminum oxide, what you saw from the lab experiment before. There are two products from the classical thermite reactions. There are two products. What is liquid iron at the temperature of 2,500 degrees centigrade, and the other is aluminum oxide, which is a white solid, which is coming out. When you're doing it in the lab, it's coming out as a cloud, and the liquid iron is going down. You know, it's used for welding rail tracks. Thermite welding is common, and the old railroad builders, they know what it is. It's used for welding tram rails. The first time it was used for tram rails, Hans Goldschmidt in Essen in Germany. It was patented in 1898. 1898, I'm sorry. Yeah. But nevertheless, So this is aluminum oxide, and kudos to David Chandler, who has taken a closer look on these fragments, and he has demonstrated that these are exploding in midair. They're reacting in midair. You can, if you care to watch as David Chandler has cared, you can see the reaction going on in the air.
And that website, by the way, is 911speakout.org.
And particularly, he has made two videos of the one is called North Tower Collapsing, and the other is called Smoking Guns from the South Tower, where you can see quite clearly four things. First thing, that the explosions is occurring above the impact point of the airliner. I mean, game over. The other thing is you can see the top section, which is tilting to one side, and then it should hit the ground, but it doesn't. It goes poof up in the open air. But the two other observations which are important here is one is a fragment which is changing here's the camera. It's going 90 degrees. It's changing direction 90 degrees. It's coming like this, and then it goes like that. Yeah. Stuff does not do that unless there is something, an impact, an impulse, which is changing direction. The other thing is an object which is moving much faster than other objects next to it, meaning that it's falling faster than free fall. Okay.
Yep.
And at that time in Toronto, you know, free form acceleration is 9.8 meters per second squared. And at that time in Toronto, I suggested this scenario for that this that what we are seeing here is nanothermite in action. And at that time, Chandler. He was quite reluctant. So he went back and then he measured very carefully on that specific fragment. He thought that it was moving faster because it had started earlier. But then he actually timed the acceleration on that specific fragment and came out with a value of 11 meters per second squared. And then he came back to me and said, okay, you're right. And then he followed up with some brilliant closer ups of the reacting. It's a beautiful example. I mean, how we work in parallel. Yeah, that's the North Tower. And I have watched this video thousands of times, because I'm using it in my presentation. And still, each time I watch this, I'm shocked how obvious it is. And look at the one going up to upper left in my, as I see the screen. I mean, this is ridiculous. Yeah, that one, come on.
Well, yeah, we were taught as kids that gravity works down. Here we have upward, outward arching streamers freely flying structural steel objects out of the towers. That one lands over 400 feet away, some of them 600 feet. So we can't explain this by gravity
alone. Of course, gravity is still there, of course, but there must be other forces as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the question then is, you have thermite, you have thermate, and you have nanothermite. What are we seeing here and why? High energy explosives too, right, Niels?
Exactly. But what we are seeing here from the outside, this is the nanothermite in action. What is going on inside in the core, a thermate cutting the columns and explosives. And the thermate, that was revealed by Jonathan Barnett from Worcester Institute of Technology very early, already in December 2001. He came with the first short communication where he revealed that, I think it was a slip by NIST that they gave him two of the steel beams you showed before with John Gross. Mm-hmm. They gave two of these steel beams to Jonathan Barnett.
And he could identify one of them as coming from World Trade Center 7 because there was a very special kind of steel being used. There were 60 kinds of steel being used in World Trade Center. And he's a metallurgist. And so he could identify where these steel beams were coming from. And he revealed that he's a metallurgist, and they're cutting, it's fantastic technology, they're cutting extremely thin slices of the steel, which mean that they can do electron microscopy and what you call energy dispersion spectroscopy on these extremely thin slices. And what he discovered was what they call sulfidation of steel. And that means formation of, sorry to be a little technical, iron sulfide. And that there's no other explanation for the formation of iron sulfide.
Well, that guess what? NIST claimed that it came from the gypsum wallboard, which has calcium sulfate in it.
That's
been used to protect steel for 100 years.
And if they had said that at a 10th grade exam in chemistry, they would have flunked the exam because it's total nonsense. Mm-hmm. But they can get along with that if they have the mainstream media behind them. So, of course, calcium sulfate, which is gypsum, can do no harm to iron. It's used actually for fire protection. Oh, come on. Okay. So, the only explanation, and I know that Barnett, he has backtracked on this hypothesis later on, obviously to keep his position. Yeah. But it perfectly fits. And the explanation we should give here is if you use thermite as an incendiary for cutting steel, you add sulfur to the mix and other stuff, potassium permanganate or perchlorate, barium perchlorate, to speed up things. But what the sulfur does is the lower the melting points of iron. In a 30% mixture, you can get the melting point as low as 991 degrees centigrade, which is actually, it's lowering the melting temperature of steel by, say, 500 degrees. And it does matter because it speeds up the process, makes it much easier. So that's the military version of thermite. There are many, many versions of thermite. And many metals, it's a very versatile reaction. But so this proves that these steel beams were cut by incendiaries containing sulfur.
Mm.
No way around that. And it fits very, so if you step back, as I did before the Toronto hearings in 2010, I mean, if you have to make a coherent model for the destruction. Or let's say the Twin Towers, Building 7 is a slightly different story. But the Twin Towers, you will need three kinds of what we call energetic materials. The occurrence of ordinary explosives could be heard by anyone standing without 10 miles from the towers. The collapse was 1 10-second roar of explosions. You can hear the explosions. And what's his name? Rodriguez. I mean, there were explosions going on in the basement all morning long. There were really explosions going on in the lobby of Building 7. I mean, no doubt that explosives were involved. And no doubt that maybe this will be the time here to tell the difference between explosives and incendiaries. Because an explosive is a chemical reaction where you have the evolution of gas very fast. Because explosives can do work. And work in physics is defined as moving things or taking things apart, which also is moving things. to work in physics is to move something. And that's what explosives can do very violently, because the pressure being produced by this chemical reaction is coming very high up, very fast. So that's why you can move things and blow things apart. So explosives can do work. Incendiaries cannot do work. Incendiaries operate exclusively by means of heat. Incendiaries can destroy things by means of heat. And thermite is an incendiary. So it does not blow the steel beams. It cut the beams, as you have said it, as a hot knife through butter. It's been used since World War I in, say, in torpedoes. So when you have a torpedo coming through the side of the ship, it's not exploding its way through the armor of the ship. It's actually burning its way through.
Oh.
And then eventually exploding on the inside. That's another thing. So thermite is, and you have thermite hand grenades. So it's used for penetrating armor in the military, and it can be very useful for other things. Now, propellants come in between the explosives and the incendiaries, because a propellant you may call it rocket fuel as well. And a propellant, you still have evolution of gas, because you have to move things like a rocket. But it should not be so fast that the rocket explodes. Elon Musk will not like that.
Yeah.
But so it has to burn very slowly from the surface and provide a thrust so the rocket moves upwards in the opposite direction. So a propellant is what you may say, a slow explosive. Actually, the old time, the very first explosives is gunpowder, invented by the Chinese, you know, in the 10th century, more than 1,000 years ago. The Chinese found out that if you mix pulverized charcoal and sulfur and a chemical called saltpeter, which you can dig off the ground if you are fortunate enough to have some saltpeter to dig off the ground. This is gunpowder. But in gunpowder, the pulverized charcoal and the sulfur particles and the saltpeter particles are fairly big particles. So the electrons have to move quite a distance. For a little electron, it's quite a distance to move from one particle to the other in order to be the reaction. So old-time Chinese gunpowder is not particularly fast, in my opinion. Modern explosives are we call molecular explosives, where the electrons have to move a much shorter distance. That's why, like TNT or nitroglycerin are so fast, because the electrons do not have to move very far. So that's why they're very fast. They're not particularly energetic. It's a mistake. The thing about explosives is, first of all, that the reaction shall be very fast and a gas is evolved. But old-time gunpowder is not particularly fast. That's why you can use it in fireworks. I mean, you see the rockets is going on. The Chinese are very good at, God bless, that it's a propellant. It's not really an explosive. So these are the three concepts we're working with here: explosives, propellants, and incendiaries. Now, enter nanotechnology in the 1980s when nanotechnology came along. And what you're doing in nanotechnology, you're making the components much smaller, and you're actually having the chemistry doing the work. When you're making gunpowder, you're mixing three powders. And good old Hans Goldschmidt, when he was making the old time thermite, this thermite mixture, he was mixing two powders. This we call the top-down procedure, because you're starting with the thing and then you're mixing them. In nanotechnology, you're building the materials from the bottom up, and you're having the chemistry do the work for you. And it has several advantages. First of all, the components are much smaller. Second, they're much more intimately mixed. Third, you can add other stuff to the material. And this time it's polymers, plastic. So the red chips we showed you before, yes, there are iron oxides in it. It's not grains. It's a kind of a lattice. And then you have nano aluminum, which actually have a very short shelf life. That's another thing. And then it's all embedded in plastic, which is maybe the key to understanding really what happened in World Trade Center. And so, because that's where the gas comes from. And that's the beauty of the nanotechnology when you in nanothermite, that you have, there's much more energy in the thermite reaction than in molecular explosives. But until the advent of nanotechnology, you could not use it to do work. So the thing is here, you add or you embed it in a polymer, in a plastic, and that's where the gases come from. Well, when you have this technology, you can tune your energetic nanothermite on the whole range from incendiaries to explosives. The modern explosives probably are thermitic. So you can tune the material on this whole range and get exactly what you want. If you want a propellant, you have another procedure, you have another plastic. But if you want an explosive, you can take it all the way to the end. And I think that is the key for understanding what's going on here, that you appreciate that you have, at least in my opinion, for to explain all the observations. Many people have said that, well, the World Trade Center, the Twin Towers, they were blown up by explosives. Other things say that they were taken down by incendiaries. And if you want to have a coherent and consistent picture of the collapse of the World Trade Center Twin Towers, you will need three kinds of energetic materials, which complicate things. It was very complicated, a masterpiece. And that is explosives, where everyone can hear and smell. And during the morning, all day long, you heard explosions. You can hear them. Obviously, we don't know what the explosives were. And you know that the steel beams were caught by thermite from Jonathan Barton Works. And you can see I didn't understand where the nanothermite fit in until 2010. And there were three times after we had finished our work on it. We have this energy, the material, the retrograde chips that were energetic. And where do they fit into the picture? And I don't know if it was David. Yes, it probably was David Chandler's work, which the obvious here. This is what you see. This is the retrograde chips. This is the nanothermite in function. This is what you see. This is the canopy. And as Chandler is pointing out, once you see it everywhere and all the time. Once you realize that this is nanothermite in action, it's everything falls into the right place. And then as a scientist, if I have a consistent model, I'm satisfied. And all this rubbish about the toasted cars and Judy Wood and all that stuff, I mean, it's yeah, and people had burns on their skin. I mean, the thing which was falling upon them, those who were happened to be close enough to the Twin Towers and they had this stuff falling on their skin, they had burns on their skin. It's so simple. The stuff was still reacting.
So it reacts even as it's shooting out of the towers and landing on the cars.
Yes, and even if we may return to Stephen Jones's and I think Kevin Ryan was the main author on the paper I told you about an hour ago in the Environmentalist, it kept boiling and brewing and reacting for the next 3 months?
Yeah, till December 19 or 20.
And that's because, I mean, a reaction is never because they were still unreacting thermite. It kept on reacting.
So it's reacting in the cars. It's like incendiary.
No, yes, yeah. No, it's reacting when it's falling down on the car.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can see the seats within the cars, they're untouched. The car didn't burn. But you have this reacting stuff falling on the roof. And it was not fun. I don't know what happened to these people who got the burns, but I would realize that it would take, if they survived, it would take very long time for it to heal. That's another thing, but this will be irrelevant chemistry here.
Well, I just appeal to our viewers today to let me know if you have come across evidence from medical records of victims having been burned, because I've been told there are none, but those are by people who are trying to make a point that this was a cold event, such as Judy Wood, that Niels just referred to, says that this is directed energy weapons. But the evidence we're looking at today is very clearly extremely hot evidence. How hot does molten iron get to, Niels?
Well, in the bulk state, the melting point is 1538 degrees centigrade. I don't know how much that is in Fahrenheit. But it's true that the iron sphere has a lower melting point. I mean, the melting point goes down when you get into these dimensions, maybe by 100 degrees or something.
Okay.
But still, it's no fun.
I know you wouldn't want to get that on.
Please notice that the model I'm suggesting here is very, very simple, and there's no hocus pocus here. I mean, it's all known chemistry. We are not introducing anything like. We don't talk about anything we do not know anything about.
Well, you can make it in your backyard. John Cole, civil engineer, did. It's got to be contained, though, right, Niels? Thermate we're talking about here, yeah. in a cutter charge like this, and it works.
Yeah. Beautiful.
It's not common. Yeah. Why isn't it more common in controlled demolitions?
I don't know. Because maybe you don't take steel frames down so often. Maybe it's cheaper to do with explosives.
It probably is.
I mean, RDX is very cheap. And it's surprising. It's so efficient. It's amazing. You steal the beam cutters. I mean, how thin they are. And they go bang right through. I mean, this stuff is so cheap. And I can explain to you why it's so efficient if you look at the formula. But Kevin has done the nanothermite in his backyard as well. I think that's a maybe more interesting experiment because he's actually seeing the evolution of a gas. But this is a different thing, his experiment. The gas being involved, maybe you've seen Kevin doing this. Kevin Ryan is doing this in his backyard, and the lid is being blown up. This is carbon dioxide.
And what does that mean?
Well, we in that case, we know the polymer. We don't know the polymer in the retrograde chips. Uh-huh. And that's a key thing. But in that case, Kevin, who makes the nanothermite in his backyard, he knows the polymer, which is, now I'm getting a bit technical as well. It's a perfluorinated alkane. And then we know the process which leads to gas evolution. So I know that the gas coming out there is actually carbon dioxide. It's not really relevant, but it's just illustrating the principles.
Well, what does the 1,3-diphenylpropane mean, and where is that found?
Well, if you, what you call pyrolyze, if you heat polystyrene, there is something formed different. Polystyrene is, I'm sorry to be technical again, it's aromatic. Styrene is an aromatic compound. And there are a range of different products coming out if you destroy polystyrene. And 1,3-diphenylpropane is coming out, but in very small amounts, which means that the other things which should come out as well, if it had been polystyrene, should have been observed, and they are not. So we never got down to it. We don't know yet.
Well, the EPA says they found one molecule at levels that dwarfed all others.
Yeah, that's it.
We've never observed it in any other sampling we've done. So that's pretty unique. Where is 1,3-diphenyl? What is it proof of, I guess is what I'm saying.
There's something we don't know. But of course, the guess of us, Kevin and us, is that it's a product of the nanothermite reaction, obviously. But it means that it's coming from a polymer, which we don't know yet. But that polymer is producing 1,3-diphenylpropane. That's it. We haven't found the origin of it. But of course, our hypothesis is that is the polymer of the red gray chips.
Yeah, he says sol gels would leave a super thermite, sol gels, which are a super thermite binder, might. That's why he says might, huh? He's guessing, huh?
Well, sol gel more refers to the technology used for producing the nanothermite. It's not in itself a substance.
Okay.
Sol gel means it's a whole range of substance, and it more refers to the technology for producing these materials.
Okay.
So, but it's a buzzword used by many people who don't know what it really means. But 1,3-diphenylpropane, obviously, I mean, where does it come from? Of course, our claim is that it's coming from the red gray chips. And one day, maybe we will have identified the polymer being used in the red gray chips, and we would know, understand. I searched around, and I never found it. You can try to maybe identify the polymer by using Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy, which unfortunately is there's no technology really fitted for doing that. What you have to do is good old chemistry. But then you need more material than we ever had. You cannot do that kind of chemistry I'm talking about here on a chip. You would need, I would like to have 100 milligrams actually of the pure stuff. And if I still had been, had my white coat and the laboratory, you might get down to actually identify the polymer. Yeah.
Okay.
You get the point.
What have you proven with this paper?
Well, the occurrence of reactive thermitic material in World Trade Center dust and nothing more.
Well, you say nothing more, but that's a pretty big deal for the rest of us, isn't it?
Well, sometimes I think it's just an academic footnote. Because if you want, there are 200 smoking guns in this whole story. If you just want to decide how the World Trade Center was a controlled demolition, all you have to do is look at the pictures we just saw before. I mean, you can see it, right? A child can see it if take the blinders off. That this is not gravity, and that's all. It takes. Took 10 seconds for the Twin Towers to collapse, and it doesn't take 10 seconds to see that this is not gravity. And the theory can only be wrong once. It cannot be wrong twice. Okay. And since it's already wrong, we really don't need the red gray chips. But if you have the itch and you are, but then what happens then? We've been driving both you and I. And all the other architects, now we know how was this done? then it fits. I mean, we provide a piece to the puzzle. And in my suggestion, it is the canopy of debris. It is the white smoke trails. Yeah. That's my suggestion. It's what is moving the things out from the twin towers.
Yeah.
So everything fits nicely. I don't think they even had to ignite the key, and you may start speculate on the one, because you have to apply this thing on the inner side of the outer panels, right?
To blow them out.
Yeah, and in my opinion, they would be triggered automatically from the explosions going on in the core. I don't think you have to trigger them electronically. Again, each time I watched this, I think there were no rehearsals, right? Not in that scale. There were no rehearsal the night before
dress rehearsal.
There were no rehearsals before that. There was only one shot.
Yeah.
And it had to come down. I mean, imagine 1 billion people watching in real time. And that's why it's overkill. I mean, obviously, it's overkill. Oh,
they weren't going to take it.
Why? It had to come down. So what would you do if you had to rig these skyscrapers for demolition? I mean, you throw in 30% at least of some of the good old stuff you knew would work. So it's complete overkill.
Well, have you extrapolated how many tons of those paint chips, nanothermite chips, must have been in here as a result of how much was found in the dust samples?
You can do. I mean, that's very extremely difficult because you're fishing out these chips from a microscope. I mean, you're weighing maybe less than 10 milligrams, which you have to multiply by 10 million. It doesn't matter. But it's meaningless. But what I did at some point, I tried to make backward calculations from the amount of iron spheres being found by the RJ Lee group in the Deutsche Bank building. Remember?
Yeah.
And they said they came out with a percentage of iron spheres of 5.87% by weight. In what they collected in the Deutsche Bank. And if you assume that number is representative for the 500,000 tons of World Trade Center dust, which was distributed all over Manhattan and into the Hudson River. Yeah, you had that somewhere.
Yeah, it doesn't distribute equally because these are the heaviest parts. It's iron after all.
So obviously, obviously, because, and this has been misused by the debunkers, that calculation I'm talking about here. Because I said, if we assume that number is representative for all the dust being produced, which is 500,000 tons, and then you make a backwards calculations, how much nanothermite would you need to produce that amount of iron spheres? The number you come out with is absolutely, totally ridiculous. And as you pointed out, the reason for that is that the samples which was collected by the RJ Lee group were not representative for the whole bulk of dust for two reasons. And then if you go into their report, they're actually contradicting reports on how they took these samples. Because on the, I don't know if it's information is still there, but on the website, they're saying that they took the samples from the tunnel going underground from what was that, the North Tower and the Deutsche Bank building. I don't remember. But there was a tunnel. And they say they're taking the sample by the end of the tunnel. And but in the report, they're taking it from the windowsills.
Oh.
And as you pointed out, the ionospheres are heavier, so they will come down. But the very fact that these samples are not representative, the very fact that my calculation came out with a ridiculous number, proves that these ion spheres did not fall from the air. They were not blown into Deutsche Bank. They were thrown into Deutsche Bank.
Yes.
They came into Deutsche Bank with the particles, as David Chandler. This was reacting nanothermite, which was simply thrown into Deutsche Bank. So did you get that? I say it again. The very fact that I came out with a ridiculous number from the backwards calculation proves that the samples being taken by the RJ Elite Group did not fall from the sky. It was not blown into the Deutsche Bank. It was thrown into the Deutsche Bank.
Yeah.
It's very simple.
Yeah.
There are many smoking guns. So it proves the existence of the nanothermite serving as a propellant, okay? Because the very thrust of the propellant made the samples taken by the RJ Elite Group out of range. Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Niels, there's a lot of questions for you. I got a bunch of them, but we've got to get to our guests. Let's bring Gail back into the stream. And Gail, what have we got for Niels today in terms of questions?
Uh-oh. Are there any?
Can't hear you. You're not on mute. Go ahead, Gail. Well, come back in. I'll read one of them from up here that I've got. It's from Dennis. He says, with all the information of two, along with Stephen Jones, I guess you two, that you've shared over the years, my biggest question is, what is the end game or goal? I've recently watched the Amazon documentary 7, and I'm curious on how the official story, which has now been proved to be false and flawed, so is there a chance NIST will update their story, and do you feel like this will ever have transparency? With the minds of many professionals, I can't see 9/11 becoming another JFK with nothing more than, and that's all I got.
Can you hear me now, Richard?
Yeah, now we can hear you. You want to read the rest of that question for Niels?
My headphones are messing up. The rest of that question is, with nothing more than speculation for years to come.
Oh.
Well, we have no speculation. There's nothing to speculate about. I think the question is, will NIST ever come clear? Is that it?
How are we going to make them come clear is another question.
But that is the question, basically. I believe for many years that I think that everything will come together in tandem. And there's more than that. And we're approaching that point. I don't think that the World Trade Center will come down alone as a single, crime. I think it will be part of the big end game, and a very important one, and I think actually the foundation of I think what the work you have done, Richard, over the years, is a basis for the awakening happening right now.
Oh.
And I feel that myself.
Uh-huh.
For all the countless presentations we have given, we have made the foundations. People are getting. Imagine what was the scene 20 years ago. People would never consider that they would be betrayed betrayed to such a frightening extent. And I think 9/11 is important as a basic revelation of the big fraud, which maybe have gone from centuries actually, but I don't think NIST or LIME Shyam Sunder and John Gross will come out and confess, or whoever did it. No, I don't think. But this is we have to do what we have to do. Reveal the information, the facts, and this is we're finished a long time ago. I mean, the evidence is there, right? And as I said, a theory can only be wrong once, but we have proven it wrong 200 times. and David Griffin, yeah, but this is how the public domain works. Actually, you know, it's not enough for a criminal to have one alibi. He must have 10 alibis to convince the jury, right? One is not enough. But Osama bin Laden had an alibi, and that is the ejected steel beams from World Trade Center 1, from the Twin Towers. I mean, that's all he needed, actually. But the public domain, they want to have more than once, and that's has been our mission and inevitable. Wow. So to Dennis, no, I don't think that NIST will come clear on their own. But one day there'll be, and this is coming up soon, I believe.
Yeah, we have to just keep pressing on because we don't know how far the trek is up the hill to where the ridge is actually that we're trying to reach.
Right.
We can't see that.
True.
Only God can see that.
And so, and 9/11 is wonderful because it's simple. I mean, two airliners, three skyscrapers. Come on, man. I mean, and there's some of the other stuff which is far more difficult to look through. But I think that the work that you have done, Richard, really, and I'm very serious, you are simply number one here, opening people's eyes to maybe things are not exactly what they tell you, right? And that is where 9/11 is so important. But the crimes committed on that day, they pales on what is going on now.
Yeah. I hear you.
Far more. 3,000 Americans were killed or in Pearl Harbor or wherever. But now we are talking about millions and hundreds of millions. But that's another thing.
Yeah.
So we have to play the role that we have to play. And you are an architect and I have still a chemist. But I don't think the Shyam Sunder will come out and confess and get clear. No. Yeah. It's very difficult to backtrack. Those are the real heroes. It's and that is another thing. It's the first lie which catch you. It's very for a journalist, if they have lied once, there's no way back. And it's why it's so important in Brussels on September 11th. Or the 12th, actually, the day afterwards, when all the ambassadors had to sign this book, when you express your regret, condolences—is that the proper English word?
Condolences.
And when all the ambassadors had to sign this condolence to the, you can see they're lining up with the American ambassadors. All the European politicians are lining up to show their condolence and sign, and that's where the hook comes in. There's no way back from there. So I think that's a very important moment. Okay. I have made a presentation on the Frank Taylor report, and we can talk about that next time. because that's where Frank Taylor, the report and the how NATO got into it and how Denmark got into it.
Yep.
And I have the paper which got NATO to war. It's lying right over there. But that's another story.
Under completely false pretenses, obviously, because if it wasn't 19 fundamentalist hijackers who did this to us, which gave justification for the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, then it was an inside operation, perhaps with some foreign help. So very, very important. Now, we're going to have to use Gail's resources to the best because she's under a time commitment, although we may not be. So let's see if we can have some additional questions here, Gail.
Thank you, Richard. The next question is from Ray. He asks, what happens when nanothermite is ignited in a jet fuel mist cloud? Does nanothermite react with jet fuel, enhance the combustion due to the oxygen from the thermite iron oxide?
Well, I honestly, in a jet engine, I would think that the airline will crash immediately. I think
he's actually talking about after the crash, Niels. Nanothermite.
I got it.
It with a jet fuel mist at that.
Now I got it. Okay. Yes. Yeah. It did. You can see it, actually. Where the airliners hit, you can see the what you call pre ignition. Yeah, you can see it in real time. You can see how the nanothermite is coming out. I can find out I showed it actually in Zurich. Because this is a very common question. I mean, how come the explosion survived the jet fuel exploding? It didn't. You can see the nanothermite being ignited. The impact points.
And then that wasn't necessarily a bad thing for the perpetrators of this event.
No, I think imagine the complexity of planning for setting up this. It was calculated. But so it did not survive the impact points. It did ignite. You can see it.
Fair enough.
Not very abundant because there were not so many cameras around at that time or cell phones who could do videos. Uh-huh. But it's somebody caught it actually on videos, and I showed it in Zurich. You can see how the fragments are coming out and going down, reacting, still reacting on their way to the ground.
And changing direction.
Yes. It's going down like this.
Okay. So it's a propellant is what's going on there.
There's a chemical reaction going on, yes.
Okay.
It's not falling to the ground.
As it's falling, yeah. Yeah.
All right. This is the next question from Craig. He says, FEMA death camp surveillance and control. Where is your evidence for your defamatory statement?
What?
Defamatory.
The FEMA camps.
They're there. FEMA death camps surveillance and control. Where is your evidence for your defamatory statement? Did somebody make a claim that they were defamed?
Well, I'm not sure.
We'll ask you to clarify, Craig. Let's go to the next question.
All right. Now, this next question is from Gene. He asks, would Niels please explain future testing for, and I'm not sure if this is a typo, but it's 1, and then 3-
diphenyl propane.
Thank you.
I knew that one coming.
Diphenyl propane.
Yeah, that can be done.
Future testing.
I haven't had the time or the capacity to do that. Uh-huh. I retired 10 years ago. I cannot make any promises. For my part, I have to leave it at that.
Is there a reason to do further testing for 1,3-diphenyl propane?
Well, that depends on what you, if you want to have the full picture and you'll be satisfy yourself with the full picture. Yeah. But really it's an academic thing. I mean, if you want to convince somebody that 9/11 was a controlled demolition, you don't need it.
There you go.
It's a footnote, but for us who got involved, I mean, it's you're thinking about it, but I don't have the capacity to do any further testing. No,
yeah, we can wake more people up by showing them Building 7 and the Twin Towers than by showing them future studies of 1,3-diphenyl propane. So it's where our best effort is placed to wake the most people up, right, Neil?
Yeah, and you will need great chunks of retrograde chips. We don't have any good samples left. And the only place where you can find good samples now will be in NISTS, safe.
Locked away for good, huh?
Probably. All right. The recipe somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be we don't know where.
Get
we
a hold of. Because this stuff's not made in a cave in Afghanistan, I assume.
Nope. We don't know where.
All right.
Nope.
Ready for another question?
Yep.
This is from another question from Ray. He says, the sound of the explosions as the planes crashed created a sonic boom. Could explosives have been used in those crashes? Can jet fuel create a sonic boom when ignited?
I'm not sure that the sound of the explosions as the plane crashed created a sonic boom. I don't think so.
Well,
go ahead.
It did. The Norde video, the very first one of the French, you've seen it 1,000 times. So have I. Please notice the next time. But you're watching, what's this called? Joseph, the fire marshal, and the rookie, and there are some visitors. What's his name? Joe Pfeiffer. Joe Pfeiffer is the fire marshal. And the rookie is standing there, and they're testing for this gas leak in the street. Yeah. Okay. And then you hear the sound of the airliner, and they're going like that.
Yeah.
And so there is something. It's not there were airliners. You can hear them before they hit. And then the camera moves around to the North Tower and watches it, and you can see the impact. And then it zooms in. The camera zooms in, and the moment the zoom is in, you hear the bang. And it's so beautiful because from the time between seeing the impact and hearing the boom, you can calculate the distance from the cameraman to the tower because speed travels by 330 meters per second. But it's actually from a scenographic point of, from a filmic point of view, it's beautiful because the zoom of the picture matches the boom from the sound.
Right, but that's of the impact of the craft into the building, not a sonic boom created by exceeding some velocity in air that creates then a sonic boom without an impact.
I don't know, but if an airliner hit the ground, I would expect some sound. I don't know.
Yes, that's different than a sonic boom. Maybe he's talking about the same thing you are, the sound of the aircraft impact, but that's a... Yeah, I agree.
The question, where does the boom come from? Is this mechanical or is it explosions of the...
Okay, there's another question.
Of explosions of the... Because if you have gasoline droplets in the air, the explosions, then you'll have a very violent explosion and a big boom.
In this case, kerosene.
This is a thermobaric weapon. And this is how you can blow up things very cheaply. You create a mist of gasoline or kerosene. And when that ignites, the thermal expansion is so bad that you have a very, very big boom and a very, very big explosion. This is a thermobaric weapon. It works the same thing with dust particles. We'll say grain silos, you have explosion. It's the same thing. Yeah. So there, in that case, yes, you will probably from kerosene getting into the building and getting like a mist, then you'll have a serious boom. But the big fireball igniting outside the building, I would not expect a very big boom. Mm-hmm. And as a footnote, ending the Norde video, please notice that the fire is actually gone out. When that little segment ends in, say, 15, 30 seconds, the fire is out. When they finish, they're watching the scene, the North Tower. And when it ends, it's basically out. It's finished.
Yeah, even NIST acknowledged that 90% of the jet fuel burns up outside the building.
Yeah.
And the rest was gone in 10 minutes, they say. So it just started the fires. People don't realize that. And then the fires lasted an hour to an hour and a half longer.
Right. Yeah. I've seen from 3 to 8 minutes, but it's the same range. Yes. Mm-hmm. Agree.
And Gail, is there one more question? Gail, you're on mute.
Yes, there is one more. This is another question from Ray. He says, did you ever read the full NISP report on the Twin Towers? Who did the calculations used in their computer modeling, and what did they not calculate?
Well, that's interesting.
Well, I did not read all the appendices.
10,000 pages.
Somebody said 14,000 pages. No, you read the main summary, and then you go into the appendices whenever needed. There are some of the appendices which are quite useful about the paint and the temperatures. That's okay. Some of the appendices are useful, but you read the main summary, 475 pages, something like that, everything included. That's what you read, and sure, I've read that. The funny
they
thing,
have a whole team of people who did calculations there in terms of who did the calculations. I'm not sure how that's relevant. You can look and see. The relevant question here is, he asks, is what did they not calculate? And I have some thoughts about that after you, Niels.
Yeah, but the NIST report on the Twin Towers did not cover the collapse. There is no technical report on the collapse of the World Trade Center Twin Towers. And I will refer to footnote number 13 on the bottom of page 82, where they admit that. Mm-hmm. Or they admit what everybody can see in plain text if they read chapter 6, which should be the probable collapse sequence. But there is no probable collapse sequence described. Fact is, they go home. The NIST report covers only the time until when they decide that now the towers are prone to collapse, which means that they leave the rest of the world to gravity. NIST leaves gravity as the only actor taking down the Twin Towers. And that was make what we talked about previously obvious.
They were tasked by Congress to explain the collapses to the American people. But they stop, as Neil says, at the initiation of collapse, citing only speculation about how it came down after that. No calculations whatsoever. And that's not rocket science. That is actually been done by structural engineers like Tony Zambodi, Richard Johns, Gregory Zudelinsky, who have challenged the NIST report in the Journal of Protective Structures.
Architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Yeah, so it's an important omission, and I'm glad that, Ray, you asked that question. Thank you.
And on their way, they used every dirty trick in the academic toolbox. Mm. And you have pointed out, and Tony Zambotia and all your friends have pointed out. So it's a hard work, tedious work.
I mean, it's from an academic point of view, it's simply fraud.
That's what they call it. And that's why we keep working the way we do nonstop for you. So let me show you a little secret message, everybody, because this is very important that you keep the work going that I can do in the podcasts like this, where we bring you the evidence, in the radio interviews, and I'm doing one or two a week now, and in the film that we're making about the 60 exhibits of evidence, such as what Niels and I have been talking about today, in partnership with the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Truth, we are making a film for the special grand jurors who will be watching this when convened. And it's a very important film. We're going to be telling you about it. And we need your support over at Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. That's LC for 911.org. And on our website, you can support us at richardgage911.org with your subscription to keep informed. What's the next incredible podcast? Well, guess what? David Chandler is coming up with the World Trade Center evidence that we've been touching on here with Niels today. So if you're excited about learning more and getting the tools so you can not look like a fool in front of your friends, then this is what you need. And also go over to AE 9/11 Truth, where I was until about 2 months ago. I still use their evidence because it's the best out there. And their architects and engineers, 3,500 of them demanding a new investigation. So they've got to be supported. And so you can use their materials to support you in your effort to wake people up. So we don't have to wait 50 years like JFK seems to be taking on. Use the momentum out there with the current false flag operation, as Niels has highlighted, and do something. And that's what Niels and I are exhorting you to do. Niels, do you have a final word on that one?
Yeah, I just keep doing what I've been doing all the time.
And you want others to do that too?
Sure. That's what we have to do. Carry on. Choice. Yeah, we just carry on.
We were born to speak the truth, and Niels and I are not the only ones. Everybody you know is who we came here to reach.
Yeah.
And so pass this along. Share widely the information you've heard today and on the website, richardgage911.org. Niels, I want to thank you so much for being here with us today. We've gained so much more knowledge, and knowledge is power in the information war. So I promise you, we're going to win it, and we're not going to give up until we do.
I realize that maybe we used more time than we had intended to, but that's because it's so interesting also, and a pleasure being in your company, Richard.
Oh, you too, my friend.
And you know you deserve all the credits for getting the truth out there.
Oh.
So thank you for this opportunity for me.
You are
to share
so welcome.
These hours with you.
And we'll sign out with this.
Thank you for joining us on yet another informative and soul-stirring episode of Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. We'll be on the air again next week with another very special guest in the 9/11 Truth Movement and beyond. Visit us at richardgage911.org, where you can find our schedule, learn about the WTC evidence, and, of course, sign up for our emails and support us. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.